Now, hello everybody. This is your host Chuck Horton coming to you live from Las Vegas, Nevada today at Freedom Fest, and joined today by Drew Lamb in the studio and in his own house, the bunker in his house, and Colby Olson secluded in his garage or wherever he does his things from. And we're joining you tonight for another episode of Double Crossed Radio coming to you live from wherever you may be. So welcome, guys.
Hey, Chuck. How's it going?
Well, I'm doing great. I'm hoping my sound's coming in okay. I'm kind of this is the first time I've tried out my new mobile application, and it seems to be working.
Sounds coming in pretty good, man.
Yep, you are loud and clear.
I brought my kids with some popsicles, so I actually got the living room for the night.
Oh, so you got it out of the garage. Excellent. Well, we were going to have the world-renowned Jeff Berwick on tonight, but he is here at this Freedom Fest also, and he's got a lot of people asking for his time, and this is kind of where he makes his contacts and does a lot of his business, which is big business for him. So I understand if trying to have him on the show during one of these conferences is kind of difficult. So we have another backup contingency plan set for you guys so that you will be entertained regardless. And I think we should start off by finally getting to cover in depth this shooting in Ashland that happened about a month ago, or a little over a month ago now, of Mr. Harris in Ashland that was killed by sheriff's deputies. And Drew, you sent me the grand jury report. I read that before the show. Just incredible how police have gotten to a point where they just go by, it's like they're going by the numbers. If this happens, then do this. If this does not happen, do this. And they don't even think anymore. They're just programmed robots that just shoot on command. And the command has already been programmed inside them.
Well, they showed up with a SWAT team.
Yeah.
They showed up. Like, they were expecting...
Seven officers.
Yeah, they were expecting to have a shootout with Earl C. Harris. That was the plan. And it looked like, reading the report, it was Sergeant Whipple who shot him in the chest.
And then they said that he... said he was sitting on the floor when they came in. When he came in. Whatever. I'd have to go through the details of this again. I don't want to get something information wrong. I'm gonna let you kind of tell our listeners the whole story, so they can. We've talked about this a couple times, but we're gonna really go into it in depth here for the first 15-20 minutes of the show, so that you understand exactly what happened and how this is gonna happen in your community if you don't step up and start to do some proactive measures to, you know, slow down the militarization of your police.
I really like it in this one, especially being ex-military. I mean, this strikes to the heart of me that this is what's happening. I mean, it's unjust, and it doesn't need to be the way that we rule our society. There's no rule from government.
Well, and this all started from a $55,000 loan that Harris had taken from U.S. Bank that, according to Harris, had been converted into a promissory note without his prior knowledge. I don't know how that happened. But then apparently he was delinquent in repaying it, and it looks like his home was used as collateral. So the bank foreclosed, and U.S. Bank, I think they were the only bidder, or they were at least the highest bidder. That usually happens when your home is foreclosed upon and auctioned off. Typically, the bank is the highest bidder. And so, let's see. I'm just reviewing the document here that came from the district attorney. So it says, the foreclosure stemmed from a loan that Earl Cranston Harris and his wife took out on the property for $55,000 in August of 2006. In court documents, Harris acknowledged taking out the loan with U.S. Bank, but claimed it was converted to a promissory note without his knowledge. Mr. Harris filed many documents with the court contesting the foreclosure over a couple of years. On March 6, 2013, a sale of the property by court order was conducted by the Sheriff's Office, and the U.S. Bank was the highest bidder, making them the legal owner of the property. Mr. Harris attended the sale. In further court proceedings, Jackson County Circuit Court ordered that Mr. Harris was to vacate the premise no later than 11:59 p.m. on May 17, 2014. The Sheriff's Office was given a writ of execution of judgment of restitution. This document commanded the Jackson County Sheriff's Department to remove Mr. Harris from the property and turn the property over to a representative of U.S. Bank. The Jackson County Sheriff's Department handles about 3 writ of execution a week, mostly from landlord-tenant situations. Yes, I've filed many of these in my day. In May 2011, the Sheriff's Office was involved in a repossession of a recreational vehicle and a golf cart from Mr. Harris. At that time, Mr. Harris came out of his home with a firearm, but put it away when requested. With this past history, there was concerns about Mr. Harris being confrontational and armed. The Jackson County Sheriff's Department decided to have additional officers accompany the sheriffs from the Civil Division. The Sheriff's Office personnel arrived in 4 vehicles. A total of 7 sheriff deputies were at the residence. They were all dressed in uniform or SWAT gear, clearly identifying themselves as police. The front gate was locked, and the police cut the lock and opened the gate. The residence has a front and rear entry. The 3 officers that approached the front door were dressed in uniform and knocked on the door. They announced that they were from the Sheriff's Office. Sergeant Grantham, the supervisor in charge of the Civil Division, spoke to Mr. Harris. The door has a window in the door. I didn't write this, by the way. This came from the DA. Mr. Harris opened the top window, communicating through the window. He refused to open the door. The police explained that they had a court order, writ of execution on the eviction. He still refused to open the door. Mr. Harris said he was going to call his attorney. He left the front door area and returned a few minutes later with what officers believe was a cordless phone. Deputy Pankava then had a conversation with Mr. Harris, again telling him to open the door. They had a court order and he needed to come out. Mr. Harris said that he was not coming out. As Deputy Pankava was standing at the front door, he could hear officers trying to make entry at the rear door. Mr. Harris appeared to hear the noise as well and went out of sight of Deputy Pankava. At the time Mr. Harris went out of view of Deputy Pankava, he did not have any type of long gun in his hands. Deputy Pankava then broke the window to the front door to be able to reach in and unlock the door. As Deputy Pankava entered the house, he was in the kitchen and could not see any other officers or Mr. Harris. Deputy Pankava then looked down a hallway and saw Mr. Harris coming toward him carrying a long gun. At this point, Mr. Harris was approximately 10 feet from Deputy Pankava and advancing toward him. Deputy Pankava recalled yelling, "He's got a gun. Drop the gun. He's down the hall." Deputy Pankava then fired 3 shots at Mr. Harris as he continued to advance toward Deputy Pankava. Sergeant Whipple was dressed in SWAT gear. Sergeant Whipple attempted entry into the rear door. When they forced entry, the door actually led to a sunroom. A secondary door leads into the home. Sergeant Whipple then attempted forced entry of the secondary door. It was blocked by a recliner chair, making entry difficult. Sergeant Whipple waited several seconds, but Harris did not come to the rear door. Sergeant Whipple then heard 3 shots. Sergeant Whipple did not know who fired at this point. He enters the residence and sees Deputy Pankava in the hallway area, looking down in the hallway. Sergeant Whipple sees that Mr. Harris is sitting up in the hallway with a shotgun in his hand. Sergeant Whipple said that Mr. Harris was focused on Deputy Pankava. Sergeant Whipple then saw Mr. Harris raise the shotgun 6 to 7 inches to a pointing position. Sergeant Whipple believed that Mr. Harris was about to shoot Deputy Pankava. Sergeant Whipple shot 1 round at Mr. Harris, hitting him in the chest. Mr. Harris then fell backwards, dropping the shotgun onto his lap. officers immediately started rendering aid to Mr. Harris. As they were applying pressure to the wounds, they located a small pistol in his front waistband. Mr. Harris was pronounced dead by ambulance personnel. During the investigation, a .38 caliber revolver was located in his back waistband. Both guns were loaded. The long gun was a shotgun that was fully loaded with alternating rounds of buckshot and slug ammunition. A number of other deputies on the scene reported hearing commands being given to Mr. Harris by Deputy Minkava and Sergeant Whipple. None of the other officers were in a position to see what had occurred, but could clearly hear commands. The Jackson County Major Assault and Death Investigation Unit was called to conduct the investigation. Under SB 111, Jackson County Deadly Physical Force Protocol, any time an officer is involved in the use of lethal force, MADIU, will be requested to handle the investigation. Officers from Medford Police Department, Oregon State Police, Ashland Police Department, and Central Point Police Department responded to assist in the investigation. Oregon State Police and Ashland Police Department worked together as the lead agency. An autopsy was performed by Dr. James Olson, the medical examiner. During the autopsy, it was determined that Mr. Harris was shot 3 times. One gunshot wound in the left upper chest along the clavicle, the second wound is in the center of the chest, and a third wound is on the left. In one of the bedrooms, 3 safes were located. Police contacted a locksmith to open the safes. Numerous guns were located, which were seized from the safes for safekeeping. Also located in one of the safes were 3 improvised explosive devices. Oregon State Police Explosive Unit responded and determined the IEDs were live. A further search revealed 3 additional improvised IEDs from a safe. In further searching, additional safes were located in a basement with items removed for safekeeping. The explosive devices were all safely disposed of by the Oregon State Police Explosive Unit. As police were investigating this case, a citizen who knew Harris approached the police. He testified that he knew Mr. Harris to always carry a firearm in his waistband. Mr. Harris had told him that he was in a fight over his property. He stated that Mr. Harris had made statements that he was upset with the bank and the judges for their actions in his foreclosure. He believed from his conversations with Mr. Harris that he was anti-bank rather than anti-government. He testified that Mr. Harris flew the United States flag upside down as a sign of distress. Deputy Pinkava has been with the sheriff's office for 13 years. Prior to that, he'd been a reserve officer in another state. Deputy Whipple has been with the sheriff's office for 14 years. The grand jury heard from Oregon State Police Detective James Meacham as the use of force expert. He previously testified as an expert on 3 occasions in courts around Oregon. Prior to his testimony, he reviewed the statements of the involved officers. He testified about action and reaction time in a situation where an officer is faced with someone who is armed. Our protocols require that a grand jury make the determination as to whether the officer's use of force was justified under Oregon law. The grand jury deliberated for less than 10 minutes before announcing their decision that the actions of the involved officers in this case were fully justified and in compliance with Oregon law. From the testimony, it was apparent that Mr. Harris knew law enforcement were at his own home to evict him. He spoke to 2 uniformed officers and refused to exit the house. He then went out of sight from the officers and retrieved a loaded shotgun. Mr. Harris was aware that officers were entering the house, and he intended to confront them with a loaded gun. The officers testified, and the evidence supported that the officers reasonably believed that Mr. Harris was about to use deadly physical force against them, giving them no choice but to fire at Harris. And that was the end of it. But they did have a choice. They had a choice to not enter the building. They had a choice to continue to dialogue. They didn't have to execute this on that day. These things are date sensitive, but I've actually conducted many physical evictions with the assistance of the sheriff, and I've had in different states even, and I've been in situations where I made a judgment call and decided that that moment was not the best moment to physically remove somebody. And, you know, and it could make it difficult. Sometimes, you know, you might end up having to go back to court and go through the whole process again. But that actually has never happened to me. And I think that if somebody had been on site who was representing U.S. Bank, they could have made a judgment call. It would have been their call, actually, whether or not the sheriff was to proceed with the eviction. It didn't have to come to this. They could have spent more time speaking to Harris, and there could have been a more diplomatic approach. So it would have taken more time. What'd they have to lose? I mean, Harris lost his life. U.S. Bank has a structure now that's obviously damaged and stigmatized. You know,
Drew, I'm so chomping to get in here. I'm going to cut you off even.
Oh,
what happened to this man? What happened to this man a while back? His wife that he loved beyond belief died, and they lost their Social Security payment. She lost her life, and she died. The love of his life died, and the Social Security payment was lost to the quote-unquote family entity that owned the house. Now, here's the problem. We have a person in a similar situation like this. Have you looked at the pictures of that trailer? I guarantee it's a 60 trailer, which means that unless it was concrete block below, it is an unsellable structure. It's not even a structure. It's just a plot of land. If it's got a well on it, it's a good thing to cap it because that's what they love to do. But that's the problem, is no one, I mean, how do you do that? How do you send a SWAT team to issue an eviction notice? I want to say this.
Well, as we know more and more about this, it could be very possible that the loan they took out was because his wife had some kind of cancer, incurable disease. And
I believe that is actually what happened, his wife had cancer, and I haven't researched this entirely, and actually what you just read to me, I haven't seen yet, so it's honestly like it's enraging to see to me, because what I'm hearing is a military-style tactic taken out on an old man that just lost his goddamn wife, and I'm sorry I'm cursing, and I don't like doing that, but I mean, seriously, he just lost the love of his life to cancer. And
yes, he's in his 70s.
Because her Social Security check is coming in, he's... What? Well, he may not have been married to one woman his whole life, or not, but, you know, he found the love of his life. They lived their life out together. I mean, he's got nothing to lose, so when you come at him like his property is an issue, and he's supposed to get survivor. So if they weren't technically married and they just lived together, he would never get survivor for Social Security, which is a gap differentiation that they do. If both of you are on Social Security, I think they do a gap difference between the one that died and the one that's living, so that you can still live, you know. They try to equal you out, but it takes a while too. I mean, shit, I've been waiting on VA benefits for 4 years, so I can understand, but, you know, it's appalling. Why would you send a SWAT team? Why? You were given the impression that you were going to induce violence. And everything that you explained in that is a tactic that I would have taken, which I wasn't actually one of those, but I was trained to do the same, in Afghanistan or Iraq as a ground clearer for a building. They took a ground clearer's building, Iraq-style, Afghanistan-style tactic into evicting an old man because he likes guns and he knows that he's being fucked. For lack of better words, he is. The government does want. When the people that really need it don't get it, and this is why, like, on the last radio show, I don't agree with this open border thing, because right now, there's a problem. We're just stealing from people to fund anything we can to move a party forward that doesn't deserve to be moved forward, that we have fought against our entire lifespan. that wants control, and we're fighting against it. Some of our anarchists are fighting against it because of the open border mentality. It's appalling to me. Everyone knows what's going on that has really looked into everything, and some of them get on board and they haven't looked at everything yet. That happens, but we're seriously dealing with a demographic that's, if you're in bed with government, you need to look at what you're doing. Even being a PCP, I don't know what's going on anymore. Chuck can feel the same thing, and Drew left because of that same feeling. David left because of that same feeling. They don't listen, they don't care, and we don't matter. The people don't matter. They don't give a hell. It's all about who has the money. The money makes the rules. And I will turn it right over right there.
Well, Kobe, I just want to make one point about the open border situation, and your stand that you're taking on it makes sense if you live in a socialist communist country, because if you let people in that are just going to come in and drain your resources, there's no way you can provide for a level of services that the people are going to expect. But if you didn't have a socialist medical system, socialist school system, socialist everything else, if you didn't have welfare and food stamps and all these other things,
and
all
Chuck, these goodies, I agree with you.
Then you wouldn't even need a fence. You wouldn't need it to check people's status coming across the border, other than just to make sure they weren't criminals. That's the only thing you'd check for, and you just let them in. And if they didn't find work, they'd go back.
But that's the thing, is we have destabilized so many countries through our wars on drugs, our illegal gun running, and so many other things that we've created this epidemic. And it's only serving one purpose that you know, and Drew really knows this too. I think that the utopia is far off, and maybe one day we will get there in an anarchist, quote-unquote, state where we don't have the
border. Socialism, I'll tell you that.
Utopia is socialism. There'll never be utopia. There are always bad people. But here's the thing. The border complexity that we're seeing right now is not the right thing. We're seeing a lot of voluntary people doing good things for this, and that's a good portion also. We're seeing voluntarianism, and it's an amazing thing.
Well, you're seeing conflict,
at the same time,
coercion, which are, you know, and I think the protesters are using, they're being defensive in the way they're using it, so I think that's justified, but they're being forced to accept something they don't want, which is not justifiable, and that's being done by the state. They're even lying and being secretive about it. They don't let the press, when the press went to view some of the quarters where these new wave of immigrants were being housed, they weren't allowed to take pictures, to talk to anybody, to ask any questions. They just were just kind of led through there like zombies and then out, and that was their press exposure to all this. So it's obviously they have something that they're doing this for. It may be to cause a diversion so they can do their other nefarious actions that they're engaged in this administration. I don't know, but it could just be a simple vote buying scam for the future. I have no idea, but I do know this, that these people wouldn't stay if you didn't have if you didn't live in it. Basically, we're pretty much a full communist country at this point. We've adopted every
point really,
the Communist Manifesto.
I don't disagree with you.
We're Common Core was adopted by 46 of the 50 states. That's communist education system. It's the John Birch Society and the New American. They've been warning about this since the 50s, and everybody just laughed at them, called them kooks and wackos, but they were right, and we've been conquered.
I'd like to jump in a little bit. You know, the I often hear the comment about how anarchists will never be able to aspire to a utopia, and anarchism doesn't need that. It's just a matter of making choices and dealing with certain people. The state can continue to exist. But I could still be an anarchist, and I could still live my life without the state interfering with it. And as long as I am surrounding myself with other like-minded people and doing business with them, and ignoring the state, I've achieved my utopia. You know, it doesn't matter. Somebody else, my neighbor, could be a socialist. That's fine. You'd actually, if the state ceased to exist, you would still have groups that were socialists, and you'd have groups that were communists, and they actually could coexist in a ANCAP society as long as they didn't aggress against the anarcho-capitalists. But they would. Ultimately, they would, because that's just the mindset. That's
because nobody's going to be foolish enough to follow their quote-unquote great ideas for humanity, because
when you have
such a poor track record of death and destruction falling behind them in their wake.
Well, right, and you can't implement a socialist system without the use of force.
Well, that's exactly right, but it's conjunctive too. I mean, it's a very complex system. We've got ourselves admitting all of this quote unquote freedom in other countries, and I went over this earlier on the other show. I mean it's the same thing, as we've got all these quote unquote freedoms being injuncted overseas in other places, but we can't actually stand up and produce freedom for the countries below us. Why don't we have a fence with Canada? Because they have everything they want. They don't care. They have natural resources. They're honestly restricted on firearms to an extent, but they're actually kind of happy with it, and they don't care. If they really felt that repressed, they do try to come over. It's very few.
To paraphrase Ron Paul, the problem with fences is that they could be used to keep people in as well, and that is clearly what this country is trying to do. It's trying to at least keep the resources within the borders, and even if you manage to get out of the country, they'll still lay claim to your labor, you know, and that's what.
But we don't actually use our resources.
What do you mean?
We conserve our resources. In real retrospect, if you look at it, look at us. We don't really use our oil.
It's only certain elite, chosen elite, get to use the resources. The rest of the people are fenced off from them.
That is true as well. But at the same time, do we really use our resources? Our environmental protection acts and everything that we've done have done what? They've blocked off our resources to where unless you're rich and can fight a lawsuit, which many people can't, you're blocked off from resources. Now think about this in a long-term scale. If you consume resources and even just raise it to the point financially where other people have to pay more for the resources they already have on their own land, like hay, milk, you know, anything you can think of, honestly, all we've ever really done is raise the price of our resources through inflation and quantitative easing in order to actually make it to where we can sustain later when everyone else is screwed. It's kind of weird, but we do this.
I'm not sure that what's out there is the finite amount of resources available. I think that saving resources for a future when they're not needed is kind of foolish also.
And so, I completely agree.
The price of energy really has a lot to do with how well your economy functions, and by enacting these regulations on the coal burning electric plants and passing all the EPA regulations, the taking out all the hydroelectric dams, they're reducing the capacity for the United States to enjoy cheap electricity. And there was a time in the 1990s when the rest of the world was complaining that it was half as expensive to produce anything, with the energy costs being that much less in the United States because of the way we managed our resources. And they were, I think that they've tried to change that to make it a quote unquote level playing field. Well, it's not level. The rest of the world pays them their people slave wages. They have environmental degradation like you can't believe. They've China people can't hardly breathe. And so it's all these things are best left out of the hands of government, because they don't know how markets work, and they don't have a clue really. and they never will. The best thing is to leave these things to markets, let the open market, the free market, establish a solution through cooperative means, and the it doesn't cost people more because people do it out of willingness, and there's no motivation, or actually there's no incentive to go out there and pollute and be known and get a reputation as a someone who's raping the earth, because there's lots in a free market, there's lots of competition, and people will avoid buying your products that you produce because they don't want to support what you're doing. But when you have a monopolistic system that's controlled by government force that uses regulations to limit competition, these elites, they do whatever they want. What are you going to do? You going to stop buying food? You going to stop buying cars? You going to stop buying gas? No.
Gas is a good point. I mean, there was a documentary on Netflix for a long time that talked about a carburetor, I believe it was back in the 50s or 60s, that got 100 miles to the gallon, and Shell bought the patent to it for like $2 million, and they just buried it on a big block V8, even. 100 miles to the gallon on, abnormal.
I remember these things have happened. School telling me about this, that the reporters went out there to see this, and a guy goes out, because they made the car very light. A guy goes in the garage and he just puts his hand on it, his fingertips of his hand on it, and he pushes it out of the garage with just the fingertips of his hand. So it was a very lightweight car. It may not have been very safe to drive, and that may have been why they decided not to produce it. But it also, I'm sure, would have gotten much greater gas mileage than the cars we get today. Just to putting the ethanol from corn into gasoline mixtures makes the mixture less efficient. It produces less energy per volume of gas that's burned, so that extra 10% that you add to the gasoline requires more gasoline to be burnt, so it's almost like it's there for nothing. It's very destructive to the parts in your engine. Anything that's plastic gets melted.
That's because ethanol is 110 octane.
Yeah, and it's all that regulation, whatever is done just to help corn farmers, to subsidize them. They're stealing the resources of other people to make the corn product cheap enough that they can put it in the gasoline. Well, that's just ludicrous. That's how the governments think markets work. They don't really understand that no one in their right mind would do that in a sane society, in a free market. They would, if it isn't as efficient, if it costs more money, why do that?
Chuck, when I lived, to be honest, when I lived at Fort Worth, Texas, you could get straight E85, which is ethanol gas, which is the corn fuel, at $2.50, when everything else was really high. And this was back in 2008-2009. I had a Honda that had $40,000 worth of modifications to it, but I could not pass it on the state level. This is probably the second or third time I've actually brought this up. But seriously, I mean, I couldn't pass emissions and put it on the road, and I transferred it because of the actual induction point. It's 110 octane. Straight ethanol is 110 octane, and it's cheaper than hell if you're in Texas because they produce the heck out of it.
Well, it's also been...
the production of it is very expensive.
The price has been subsidized by government. Oh, they have over.
I couldn't actually drive my car on the road with it.
They have over 30 different kinds of subsidies that corn farmers get. Watch that movie. What was it called? Big Corn.
I've seen that one. Definitely. Yeah.
Yeah.
I've seen it.
It's amazing. Those guys.
A lot of them.
Nobody makes any money on it until they get their subsidy money back. And that's the only way the farmers make any money. They all lose money on their crops, but they get saved in the end by the government subsidy money. That's just ridiculous.
Yeah, but who's the one that grows the corn seed?
Well, none of them would grow corn seed if they're losing their ass on it every year. They just flip to a different crop.
No, who is the one that actually grows the seed that they're using?
Oh, I'm sure it's Monsanto. They seem to have their hands into everything these days.
And while it's not them, it's really Bill Gates. He's got his hands everywhere.
He's a major stockholder in Monsanto now. Yep. Well, I think that we've kind of drifted off the subject of poor Mr. Harris. I think we got to make some concluding statements regards to him. And he's His death is really a tragedy for Southern Oregon. It's largely a result of giving the police this weapon, this SWAT team weapon. And when you give somebody a new tool like that, every problem is going to look, you know, like a nail and you're a hammer. It doesn't matter if this requires a different kind of tool. It's going to look to them like, hey, this is something we need the hammer for. And in this case, as Drew pointed out, I think a lot better outcome could have been reached. And, of course, hindsight is always going to be pretty accurate. It's going to seem more reasonable than that horrible outcome that we had. And I do understand that police are in a stressful position. They don't want to die, and they see something that looks like they could get shot. And Officer Whipple, is it Sergeant Whipple? Well, whenever, when he saw the guy, he was sitting on the floor. He already been shot twice. And he just gave him a point blanker in the chest. Pretty hard to miss on that shot. But
I couldn't tell you right now, but if I'd been shot a couple times,
Drew was saying, they knew when they were going in there that this guy was armed and dangerous, potentially dangerous. They knew he's under stress. They knew his whole situation, and yet they chose to escalate the situation, which, you know, just shows really poor judgment. But it's that same mentality. They've been trained to operate as a SWAT unit in a certain manner, and as police officers in a certain manner, and it's military training. It's how you act in a theater of war. It's like rules of engagement, and they're just taught over and over and over again that this is how you react to these situations. It saves your life. Well, it saved the police officer's life in this case, but I don't know if this is.
I really want to chime in on that one.
There's a reason the founding fathers put in the Constitution the statement said there was never to be a standing army in the United States. And what difference does it make if you've converted your police over to a standing army, whether you have that in the Constitution anymore? They're not. They've been trained by the federal police task agencies. They've been given surplus military equipment like MRAPs, and they've been trained in the SWAT team raids are similar to house-to-house combat that they do in war zones, and they're the equivalent of a standing army. And this is something that we should never have, because now on the other side, we have all these movements out there to try and take guns out of our hands, to demilitarize the public, to take away our ability to stand up to brutal police forces, or police forces that are corrupt, like down in New Mexico, where they kill people just for sport, it seems like. And they seem to get away with it time after time after time. They've got the grand jury wrapped around their little finger. So I think this is really serious tragedy that's happened in Southern Oregon, and I think that I would hope that people in the community wouldn't react to it so emotionally, and it's hard not to. I have an emotional reaction to it. When I first heard about this, I just almost wept. But we want to logically say, what is the future going to look like if we continue down this road? And I don't think it's going to be very pretty. People cowering in their homes and just hoping and praying the police don't come knocking at the door. And I don't know how to live in that kind of society. And so I would just hope that you get a chance to talk to anybody about this, or it gets brought up in a conversation and group that you're within, that you kind of bring to everybody's attention that, you know, this started a long time ago, back in the 80s, when they started creating SWAT teams and started the process of militarizing our police. And as it gets more and more militarized, they become more and more a standing army on our own soil. And they're being used against us. They don't follow the rules that we have to follow anymore. So that's what I think is the sad thing that we have to learn from this. And but my thoughts and prayers and best wishes, condolences and everything else go out to Mr. Harris's family and surviving family. This is just a tragedy that nobody should have to deal with, to be killed by your own government. And I know there's people out there that say he had it coming, he shouldn't have had a gun in his hands. The man was losing everything he had. He just lost his wife. He's losing everything. Can you have just a little compassion? I mean, have you no shame, Jackson County sheriffs? Are you just hired guns? Are you just mercenaries? Are you just hired killers? Is that all you're good for? Or is there still something in there called protect and serve in your oath to take office? And you serve U.S. Bank, but you also serve Mr. Harris. And just, you need to take that and have it in balance, and you need to find a way to help him with his situation and allow the rule of law to stand on the property. Now, if the U.S. Bank may have been complicit in fraud and getting him to sign a paper that he didn't understand what it was so that they could come by and foreclose on his property later because they knew he couldn't pay this off. Or maybe they shouldn't have allowed the loan. Maybe he was desperate because his wife was very ill, which I think probably was the case, and it was willing to sign his name on anything. And so that'd be called a signature under duress, and I think that would be classified as invalid because it's kind of a forced signature. And anybody that takes advantage of somebody in that situation is really just pathetic. It used to be that hospitals around this nation wouldn't refuse service to anybody. It was a Hippocratic oath. Someone who's sick wouldn't have to worry about going to mortgage everything they owned to get treatment. And it's the road to fascism is a road to serfdom, and it's a horrible, horrible end to a civilization, a once great nation. And the vampire economy is going to suck out everything it can out of this economy, and it won't leave anything left that's very pretty. It's going to just devour you. It just puts its little plunger into your heart and sucks all the blood out of your body, and you're left with nothing. You don't not enough to live on. You're just a wisp, and you just float away. And then they go on to the next victim. And every fascist economy always ends up the same way, and that's kind of what it's looking like here right now. I know before I was talking about communism, socialism. Now I'm talking about fascism. They're all this, you know, three sides of the same coin. It's a three-sided coin. They're all collectivist systems, and they all end up the same. And that's one of the great lessons in the book, Road to Serfdom. If any of you haven't read it, you need to read it. F.A. Hayek, it's a classic. It's still in print after over 50 years. I think it's 60 years now. And if you haven't read it, you need to read it. It's an anthem for liberty. So this has taken up almost all of our show. Drew, do you have anything other comments to add on Mr. Harris? Because you really had it. That was awesome reading of the and your comments about it at the beginning were awesome comments. It really kind of inspired me.
Well, I'm glad we were able to touch on this again. It was something that I wanted to talk about. I've driven by his property a few times while I was out doing my work, and so I think about him often, and I'm alarmed that we have this militarized police force right here in our neighborhoods. And I really don't like the way they handled this. You know, I think this was very poor leadership. And this is coming from somebody who's been involved in hundreds of evictions. You know, this absolutely could have been handled differently. I could have handled this, and nobody would have had to fire a shot. Nobody would have gotten killed, and the bank would have gotten their property. It's all about diplomacy. Use your head. You talk these things through.
Yeah, you give the guy a better choice.
Even if it had taken a few extra weeks to get him out, it would have been worth it.
Yeah, I don't think there's anything the U.S. Bank, I think they would have paid almost anything to avoid this kind of publicity. This is not the kind of thing you want to be associated with as a bank. You might as well be wearing a shirt that says Simon Legree on it.
But that's the problem, though. It's not actually being broadcast as U.S. Bank.
It is now.
Well, do it. Do it, as always. I know better. We've got other avenues to do things. But at the same time, it's just sad that... I mean, it makes me want to cry, honestly, because that could be me. You know, I could... My roommate could have moved out. I didn't have other assets to sell to actually live in the house I'm in. And that could have been the sheriff's department showing up here because I have a Jefferson State flag out front and shooting me dead in front of my children. I mean, and people don't realize these things at all. I mean, it's that's the seriousness nature of this. It says you're talking about a man that's lived in this house for how long? Since the 60s. His wife dies, and he's bent with that mourning, first off, and then he's bent with the second mourning, where Social Security is not going to help him out with the actual payment for the house. And it's, in one sense, it's the government owns you. I mean, they do.
There's other aspects.
You got this great debt, and once your wife dies, guess what? You can't pay it, so we're coming for you.
There's other aspects of government that are complicit.
It's just not right.
The property taxes are another. I mean, people who go past the age of 65, when they're no longer able to really earn a living anymore, and they're still taxed on their property, that's just obscene. In fact, it's obscene that they're taxed. Anybody's taxed on their property, but it's even more obscene when the people really are in a state at the position in their life when they no longer have the ability to make those payments. So, that, in a sense, they get they never really own any property. It's always just rented from the state, and that to me seems really awful too. And that's probably one of the reasons why this. And the guy may not have been very good with money either. I mean, he obviously spent a lot of money on guns and explosives. So, maybe he was putting his resources in the wrong spot. But that aside, people have the right to be wrong. And he hadn't hurt anybody, unlike the sheriff's deputies.
See, but that's honestly the thing, is the actual structure that he was living in isn't actually something that they can use for a sellable purpose for that land at all. If you look at the pictures of the trailer, there is no way in hell.
Yeah, and that was kind of.
He is allowed to use that actual structure for sale purposes, nor is Bank of America, besides saying, hey, come get it, it's free. We want it off the land.
Well, that's kind of the point I was making, that for U.S. Bank, there had to be a better solution for them. A $55,000 loan, it's going to cost them, millions probably to overcome this bad publicity. This is not a good business decision either. And as Drew was saying, there's so many better options than what the course of action was taken, and it's just a tragedy.
But we got the news.
We shouldn't leave these kinds of decisions up to people that think every problem is a nail, because their only tool is a hammer. They only have one action.
I completely agree with that. That's the problem. Well, our local news did the same thing.
We see this meme around Facebook all the time that says we need more Mayberry and less Fallujah, with Andy Griffin on there.
Yeah,
and that's pretty much it. I mean, these guys were out for blood. You know, they dressed up in their silly costumes and went out there, with their AR-15s, and they wanted to hunt a man. They were on a man-hunting adventure. And it was ruined out.
They don't have AR-15s.
I don't know what they're using.
They're using actual assault rifles, quote-unquote.
Regardless, I doubt.
Oh, you're saying that they're using full auto weapons.
I think they.
No, what I'm saying is that they actually have select fire, so they can go single shot, or they can go 3-round burst, or they can go full auto. The cops have whatever they want. It's not like you or me filing a tax stamp and getting a silenced.
Right. Exactly. Right.
It's completely different. They get whatever they want.
Yeah, that's a.
They have.
That's a topic for a whole.
I build AR-15s. I build AR-15s, and they don't have AR-15s that are semi-automatic. They have whatever the hell they want, whenever they want it.
I try to put a little announcement in for a future show. I think I made a contact today. It's somebody who knows somebody, so I haven't made the full contact yet. But somebody who's very much a ballistics expert lives up. In the area a little bit north of Albany, Oregon, in Scio. And he just loves to come on gun shows and talk about ballistics and how to make your own ammunition and things like this. And I told him I had two co-hosts that would love to have a show like this. So in the near future, I think we're going to have a show on guns for everybody out there. So that's unfortunately that this is probably coming out of the fact that we have to become prepared to fight our own police and in some cases. And that's just really, it shouldn't be that way. That, I mean, if people think that that's justified, and I even have people in my own family who said, well, I would have shot him. And I just kind of go, oh, my God, I got work to do. I don't think these guys are wearing a bulletproof vest. I don't think the guy's shotgun is going to tear a hole in a bulletproof vest.
Well, you know, there's other areas you could hit.
There are. And it's, he'd already been shot twice when he was sitting in the hallway, and I think that he was probably already in shock, and the guy just, they were panicking. They'd never been in such before. They were scared out of their wits, and so they just shot him.
Well, the problem is that you know, they can claim that it was done in self-defense, but they put themselves in that situation.
That's right. And they escalated it to that point.
It's like if you stepped in front of a truck and it ran you over. You know, you put yourself in that situation. So, yeah, the militarized police. I mean, it's a problem that with the gear that they're given, as well as the atmosphere that it creates. And
it's not even just that, man. It's the training that comes with it.
I've
been through this training. I know this training, but I actually, as a soldier in two different atmospheres, took the medevac aspect and I took the non-combative. I cannot shoot unless fired upon.
Right.
I can call in airstrikes. I can call in all these things. A-10s, you know, Harriers, whatever I want to call in, I can call them in. But the difference is I was fixing people. And even then being a soldier, you still put yourself subjective to a PTSD environment. And now we have a war on veterans. We have a war on 3%ers. We have a war on anarchists. We have a war on everybody. We have a war on the insane clown posse, for crying out loud. And they're really not that cool. I mean, nobody cares.
Yeah.
Nobody really, if you really care about the insane clown posse, you probably should get a life. No offense to anyone, but the music was cool when I was a teenager, but they're not a terrorist organization. So
no, they're just KISS copycats.
Yeah, yeah, they're KISS in a more like semi-rock era. Yeah, I used to listen, but in the same point, it's like we've created so many different demographics of quote unquote terrorists that we don't have real people anymore. So if you're on the side of Cassandra Rules and you're on the side of PMBers, you're a quote unquote anarchist. If you're on this side, you're this. All we have done is divide everything into subjective matter that could be placed against each other. And it's horrible because most of us actually have the same objective. But we're so placed against each other that nothing happens. I mean, Chuck and Drew,
yes.
Actually,
I would agree
into a decent in-depth conversation for another 2 hours on how that's happened in the Republican Party with the Ron Paul movement, this, AFP, and with everything you could ever imagine. And they know exactly what I'm talking about.
There's good reason for these groups to not trust each other because they get infiltrated by people who are really lacking in integrity, and so you tend to paint everybody with that same brush. I mean, I don't like to tell people that I'm a PCP in the GOP because I don't want to be associated with those people. I don't want people to think that I actually rub elbows with that kind of scum. But, you know, and there's certainly a lot of liberty people that are PCPs that aren't scum, but that alley guy that was the head of the state.
You and I are too.
Well, that guy wanted to shake my hand. And I really don't want to touch him.
Why? I don't. I wanted that to rub off on me either. But, I mean, we've done so much, and there's a lot of people that have left the movement and just been like, no, I'm in between. Well, the problem is if you don't, because how the system works, if we don't become aligned as one, which we've actually done this county, by the way, it's been done in mine, Chuck and Drew's county. We have the numbers now. We are the leading pack. Thank goodness.
Yeah, and the same thing happened in Lane County, for goodness sakes. Can you believe that? The system was overthrown in Lane County by a bunch of peaceful anarchists? Wow.
What?
Let's give a big shout out to Dwayne up there. He did an awesome job.
They will get violent with their words, but they will not actually get violent. But, yes, exactly. I mean, there's been a lot of movements that have overtaken things, and sometimes being involved is actually the true faction that you need to find. Sometimes things don't work your way, but if you continue to be involved...
I'll say this for all the scummy people that are solid. I've found some really genuinely good people within the GOP that I really like being aligned with, but I don't mention them as that's the reason I'm aligned with them. I mention from their being aligned with Americans for Prosperity or Campaign for Liberty and these organizations because I have more pride in being associated with those organizations, even though I don't technically belong to them. Well, because I think those are good people that are actually trying to be very positive, and they're not out there to try to serve some special interests. They're just out there for general principles of freedom. And those individuals, there are a lot of those people. I'm going to mention one of them by name. I think Tom Steen is just an awesome guy. I am so glad that I've met that guy. He's very inspirational. So we're getting close to the end of the show. Went by really fast. This was very interesting for me. I hope that everybody out there listening had the same level of enjoyment of this conversation. We covered a lot of stuff, and we were just going to try and talk about the senseless death of a local resident that's really kind of upset the three of us very much. And I'd like to see his death mean something in our future.
As a veteran, I can say that, honestly, all I saw out of what was stated by Drew with military tactics being taken, and that really appalls me because that's not. When I was in the military in Afghanistan, 506. This is kind of what I saw.
Okay, good night, everybody. Thanks for listening.